the first thing one would say about Xi Jinping thought is that he puts the party at the center of everything.
Welcome to Global Dispatches, a podcast for the foreign policy and global development communities and anyone who wants a deeper understanding of what is driving events in the world today. I'm your host, Mark Leon Goldberg. I am a veteran international affairs journalist and the editor of UN Dispatch. Enjoy the show. Looking for a trustworthy podcast to bring you unfiltered viewpoints and experiences on global health? Tune into Global Health Matters, the podcast that connects silos and amplifies diverse voices to give you a holistic picture. Each month, Dr. Gary Aslanian from the World Health Organization hosts discussions with guests spanning former ministers of health, award-winning journalists and authors, and frontline public health workers. Join listeners from across 180 countries for an exciting season 4, launching in June. Global Health Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Xi Jinping has dramatically reshaped China since coming to power in 2012. He is now effectively a leader for life, and throughout his time in power, he has bent Chinese politics and society to his own ideological predilections. Understanding this ideology, so-called Xi thought, is crucial for understanding how China sees its role in the world today. Steve Tsang is director of the China Institute at SOAS University of London and co-author with Olivia Chung of the new book, The Political Thought of Xi Jinping. The book offers a thorough analysis of the development and application of Xi's political ideology and how that impacts China domestically and in its international relations. We kick off our conversation with a discussion about why understanding Xi thought matters to understanding China today. We then discuss some of the key tenets of his ideology before having a long conversation about an ancient Chinese imperialist ideology that Xi is reviving for the modern world. And as always, please visit globaldispatches.org to sign up for our newsletter. You can become a paid subscriber to the newsletter and unlock bonus content as well. So please visit globaldispatches.org to support our work, or you can become a premium subscriber directly in the Apple Podcast app. Thank you. Now, here is my conversation with Steve Tsang, co-author with Olivia Chung of the new book, The Political Thought of Xi Jinping. So, Steve, before we discuss the key tenets of Xi thought and its foreign policy implications, I'd like for you to make the case for why understanding the political thought of Xi Jinping matters. You know, in many countries, and not just the West, ideology is just one of many influences that can shape policy. What makes China so unique and different than that?
What makes China different and the political thought of Xi Jinping matters is the reality that Xi Jinping has changed the way how China operates. Now, he has not changed the political system. The system remains one of a Leninist party state, which means that the party superintends the state institutions. But the way how that system operates has been changed.
Explain how it's been changed under Xi Jinping through his ideological predilections.
If we can look at this using the language of the digital era, when the People's Republic of China was created under Mao Zedong, it operated under Operations System 1.0, and we have the Maoist era of totalitarianism. When Deng Xiaoping took over from Mao at the end of 1978, he essentially replaced the operating system by 2.0, which is what he calls the reform and opening up approach. After Xi Jinping has consolidated power at the 19th Party Congress in 2017, 5 years into his rule, he put forward the thought of Xi Jinping as the new ideology of China and therefore the new operating systems. Because it is a party state, not a democracy, when the party that controls everything changes the way how it operates, it changes the way how China behaves, both domestically in terms of its governance and relationship with its people and how it manages the economy, and externally what its ambition is globally and how it engages with the rest of the world. So if we understand the political thought of Xi Jinping, we have a pretty good view of what Xi Jinping wants China to do and achieve, and how he proposed to steer China to its promised land.
Let's dig into that a little bit then. What are some of the key tenets that you identified in your research, in your book, that make up what you call Xi thought?
Well, what Xi Jinping aims to do domestically is to forge one country, one ideology, one party, one leader, and one people. Externally, what he aims to do is to change the way how the international system or the international order operates, to move it from the liberal international order into something that is Sino-centric, and therefore fundamentally change the way how China's relationship with the world develops. Now, if I go back to more specifically about the domestic policy, the first thing one would say about Xi Jinping's thought is that he puts the party at the center of everything. He openly said that at the 19th Party Congress, that it matters not whether it is in the north, south, east, west, or in the middle. It matters not whether it is in party matters, government matters, educational matters, civilian matters, or any other walks of life. The party leads everything with no exception.
And that's a departure from prior era?
Well, it is a significant departure from the Deng Xiaoping era, because the Deng Xiaoping era was a period when the Communist Party only required people to support the Communist Party's hold to power. In return, they allow people to have individual freedoms to do what they want to do, and effectively only pay lip service to the state ideology. So much so that you would have some people who would say that communism in China was in name only. And you have very China-friendly academics like Professor Daniel Bell, who would go to the extent to say that the CCP no longer represents the Chinese Communist Party, but it represents the Chinese Confucianist Party. Now, this is not the case any longer. The Communist Party of China today is the Communist Party of China, firmly under the control of Xi Jinping, doing the biddings that Xi Jinping instructed to do.
And it seems, I mean, interesting and also remarkable that these ideological tenets are not just documents that are out in the ether or sayings of Xi Jinping, although there are, but they're also like embedded into the constitution now of the party and the state.
It is very much embedded in the constitution of both the Chinese state and the Chinese Communist Party. And indeed, everybody in China, not just the 95 plus million members of the Communist Party, are required to learn Xi Jinping thought. And if you go into any educational establishment from kindergarten to graduate school, you have to learn Xi Jinping thought. You have to do so if you are in a state-owned enterprise. You have to do so if you are in a private enterprise which has more than three members of the Communist Party in that enterprise. And you are encouraged, if not yet fully required, to have an app on your phone or mobile device to make sure that you learn Xi Jinping thought regularly on a daily basis. And the app, of course, is able to monitor the usage of the app you make on a daily basis.
And I was interested to learn from your book that usage of that app skyrocketed during like the COVID lockdown period.
Well, it changed partly because when the app was first introduced, only members of the Communist Party were required to use it on a daily basis. Others were encouraged but not required. During the COVID pandemic, they modified the app to make sure that it becomes one of the most user-friendly ones for you to gain a green pass in order to gain access to places under lockdown. So it became a very useful app for people to have. Not the only one that you can use it for that purpose, but it's a very useful one to have. And subsequently, it becomes a requirement that people should have the app beyond being members of the Communist Party. So yes, its usage becomes quite significant.
Is it fair to say that the key tenets of Xi Jinping thought is embedded in the idea of socialism with Chinese characteristics?
Well, it is and it isn't. It is because that is formally what it says it is. It isn't in the sense that what does socialism with Chinese characteristics mean? Because that was a usage which was being put forward by Deng Xiaoping in an earlier era. And most of what Deng Xiaoping preached have now been reversed by Xi Jinping. So the same description now means something very different from when it was introduced by Deng Xiaoping. What is also interesting here is that Xi Jinping time and again declare that he is a Marxist. But in the study that I and Olivia have conducted, it becomes increasingly clear the variant of Marxism that Xi Jinping preaches is one that Karl Marx, if you could bring him back from the grave, would not recognize. Wants to deliver social justice through a kind of welfare support. He would criticize that as welfareism. He instead comes up with the idea of common prosperity, which is to narrow the gap between the rich and the poor, and also requires the super rich to give money to philanthropic causes. But he's not doing the kind of redistribution that a communist state is required to do, is dedicated to do. He does not believe in the communist utopia, which is a society in which one contributes according to one's ability and one takes according to one's needs. And ultimately, the state will wither away. Xi Jinping does not buy into any of those.
So in foreign policy, you identify Tianxia, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it's an ancient Chinese concept as the ideology underpinning Xi's approach to international relations. What is that?
Well, Tianxia.
Tianxia, apologies.
Not at all. It consists of two Chinese characters, sky and below. So it is essentially all under the sky or all under heaven, literally the whole world. Now, the idea of Tianxia that Xi Jinping preaches is not completely in line with what historians studying China's relations with its neighbors in its imperial heydays would understand. in the real history, China behaved like a real empire, similar to what, for example, the Roman Empire at its heydays would behave. But in Xi Jinping's reconstruction, and here Xi Jinping's historical reconstruction is important because he has, since 2013, prohibited any version of history that is not his version of history. So what he says must now be accepted as the true and only version of history. So in this reconstruction, when China was at its heydays, China would have been the most magnificent, technologically advanced, logistically capable, militarily strong state in the world. And it would be the most magnanimous state as well. So all its neighbors would be inspired by the model of China and the excellence of China and wants to imitate China and certainly defer to China. And because they would all do so, then a kind of Pax Sinica, Chinese peace, would prevail. And China would therefore not need to use force, but be the global leader in the most magnanimous way. Now, this is the theory. And this is what he would like the world to be like. And he would see himself, the Communist Party, and his ideology as forces for good. And he would certainly make sure that people in China will all benefit from that. And he's happy to share that with the rest of the world.
It's like an ideology of benevolent imperialism.
Yes, but let's not forget, in the heydays of the British Empire under Queen Victoria, the British thought the same.
Right.
So did the Romans and the Persians and many other great empires in human history.
How does the ideology of Tan Xia interact or seek to explain the kind of existence of the so-called rules-based international order? How might they interact? Because, you know, at least today, you know, we're not seeing explicit efforts by a rising China to object to the Western system, to object to the United Nations. Rather, you know, they're working within that system. So what do we need to know about the relationship between Tan Xia and the kind of world order as it exists today?
The rule-based international order that we talk about in the West is what effectively the liberal international order put in place at the end of the Second World War. Now, again, history would say that China was a key player in the founding of the United Nations at the San Francisco Conference of 1945. And indeed, even the Communist Party of China was represented in the Chinese delegation. But the Chinese government under Xi Jinping these days will forget about that history and simply say that the liberal international order was imposed by the West for the West and is there to serve the West, taking benefits of the post-war situation. And it is fundamentally undemocratic because it looks after the interests of the minority of the so-called democratic West, whereas the numerically much greater, both in population terms and in country terms, of Global South are underrepresented at the international order, including the United Nations. But China upholds the international order, and it merely wants to work with its natural friends and partners in the Global South, because Xi Jinping says China is and will be forever a part of the Global South, therefore its natural leader. And with the support of the Global South, China will then transform the way how the United Nations and its agencies and other international organizations in how they operate to make sure that the interests of the Global South are properly recognized and represented. And he calls that a democratization of the international system. So it is transformation from within, turning the liberal international order eventually into a Sinocentric Tensha order.
It's interesting. I mean, as a reporter who covers the United Nations, I certainly see elements of this happening. You know, you see Chinese officials seeking to run for the heads of various UN agencies, where really when I started my career 20 years ago, that wasn't much the case. You also see China becoming increasingly more active in kind of in the weeds negotiations around UN budgets, which again, 20 years ago, you didn't really see. So, you know, this is happening, at least in a limited scale right now.
Oh, it is very much happening. And this explains why China is putting so much emphasis on cultivating relationship with countries in the global south. You may recall that last year, 2023, Xi Jinping did not bother to attend a G20 summit, but he made all the way to South Africa to attend the BRICS summit, because the BRICS summit is one that has the potential for China to upgrade into something to engage with the global south, get support from the global south, so that China can make that transformation. Let's not forget that what China has to offer to many countries in the global south can be and often are very attractive to those countries, even if they do not come across to Western people that they can be very attractive. And here I'm really referring to, for example, the Belt and Road Initiative development projects. They may be problematic in terms of the sustainability, but let's not forget that a majority of countries in the global south are autocracies with very, very poor credit rating, which means that those autocratic leaders could not borrow money from the World Bank, ADB, or any of the other major international development banks for their development projects. China will loan them money without conditionalities on governance or transparency, and they would also only deal with leaders in those countries rather than with people in those countries. And all they ask in return are three things. One, China gets the lion's share of the contracts. B, those countries support China over Taiwan. Three, those countries support China in China's initiatives at the United Nations and other international agencies. So the autocrats don't have to pay. Somebody else pay in return for the Chinese loans. And they are attractive propositions.
Yeah, it is interesting as you describe it to understand the Belt and Road Initiative as a manifestation of the Tansha ideology as you describe it.
Yes, because the Belt and Road Initiative does not make huge amount of sense either as a development aid program. It's largely development loans, not a development aids. It's also not a good economic investments for China, because most of those loans cannot be paid back. It really doesn't take a lot to work out. The loans will have to be restructured in most cases. And for those who like to see China as laying a debt trap for the countries, they really are not producing much evidence of China using those loans to seize controls in those countries. There is something bigger in terms of investment objective.
And just on that point, I did a whole episode of the show a couple of years ago on the myth of the debt trap idea. So I'd encourage listeners to check that out. I did want to ask you about, you know, the elephant in the room, and we're talking about China foreign policy, the question of Taiwan. What is the ideological basis of Xi's thought in terms of how it views what she calls the peaceful reunification of Taiwan? Where does Taiwan fit ideologically in Xi thought.
Taiwan sits very importantly in the schema of things in the political thought of Xi Jinping. Taiwan matters hugely because it is geostrategically critical to China. It is located bang in the middle of what Chinese maritime strategists call the first island chain in the Pacific Ocean. And the first island chain goes essentially from the southern tip of Japan through Taiwan into South China Sea, including basically the waters under the 9-9. And the securing of the first island chain will entirely secure the Chinese eastern seaboard and provide the expanding Chinese Navy and Air Force the power to project into the Pacific and therefore potentially consolidate its security over the second island chain, which would divide the Pacific Ocean into two between the Americans on the eastern side and China on the western side. But more importantly, China can only take Taiwan, or take Taiwan back, depending on your perspective, by going eyeball to eyeball with the United States, given that the United States has a commitment under an American law, the Taiwan Relations Act, to provide assistance to Taiwan for its self-defense should its status be changed against the will of the people of Taiwan. Now, where does the peaceful reunification idea comes from? Well, Xi Jinping would like it to be done peacefully, as indeed his predecessors would like too, but that will require Taiwan effectively surrendering. Here we have a bit of a difficulty, which is that a democracy, which is a medium power, believing that it enjoys the security commitment of the only superpower, does not surrender. In history terms, medium powers that are democracies has never surrendered under an existential threat. They've always fought, in some cases successfully, in others not. But either way, whether China takes Taiwan by Taiwan surrendering or by taking on the American forces sent to help Taiwan to defend itself, it would bankrupt American credibility in the Indo-Pacific if the American guarantee under the Taiwan Relations Act ultimately either fail or cannot be relied on for security. It will be a scenario that countries like Japan or South Korea would either have to go nuclear or they would have to do deals with China. And the ASEAN 10 in Southeast Asia will all have to do deals with China separately. And fundamentally, it would change the balance of power in the Indo-Pacific and would drive the Americans out of the Western Pacific. It would be the kind of changes that will fundamentally raise questions about American global dominance. It may even raise questions as to whether the United States could still be relied on as the key backer behind NATO. So it is a big deal. It is a critical step for Xi Jinping to secure if he is going to change the international order into one that is resembling that of his conception of the Tianxia.
That's a fascinating explanation, I think, of the ideological basis of the Taiwan question. So, you know, just kind of stepping back from like the application of these ideologies to things like the Taiwan question or the Belt and Road Initiative, I'm curious to learn from you, like, how malleable is Xi thought? Say circumstances change and China, you know, suddenly overnight becomes just much weaker, say, vis-a-vis the United States. Could Xi thought adapt to that new reality, or is it very much like hardline and unmalleable?
I think here what we are dealing with is not so much whether the thought itself is malleable, but about how much Xi Jinping is a realist. And my answer is that Xi Jinping is a realist. If Xi Jinping sees a crisis emerging that could potentially destabilize his rule and threaten his hold to power, he will change and adapt and do whatever it takes to stay in power. Now, if he is only seeing a relative weakening of China's position, I think his default response is to double down. Again, let's not forget that some of the changes that have happened in the last 10 years include, one, a replacement of collective leadership at the top of the Communist Party by strongman rule. What does that mean in governance terms? It means that the days under the tail end of Deng Xiaoping's era through Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, when the Communist Party top echelon encouraged free internal debates behind closed doors on policy matters, has now been replaced by an echo chamber. That increased scope for internal debates for over a quarter of a century before Xi Jinping enables the Communist Party to avoid making major policy mistakes that could destabilize the system, even when communism collapsed in Eastern Europe and then in the Soviet Union. The replacement of that venue for debate by an echo chamber means that there's now nobody who can tell Xi Jinping how the world has changed and how things can be getting very, very difficult indeed. And Xi Jinping still believes that China is in a historic moment of great change. He told his buddy, President Putin of Russia, that we are in a moment of history when great changes are unfolding, the kind of changes that happens only every century. We are the agents driving those change. Xi Jinping believes the East, meaning China, is rising and the West is declining. So that is the general trend that he sees. So temporary setbacks will not necessarily change the way how he sees the world. But if he sees a direct threat, yes, he will act on it.
Thank you so much for your time. This is absolutely fascinating.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Global Dispatches. The show is produced by me, Mark Leon Goldberg. It is edited and mixed by Levi Sharp. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to follow the show and enable automatic downloads to get new episodes as soon as they're released. On Spotify, tap the bell icon to get a notification when we publish new episodes. And of course, please visit globaldispatches.org to get on our free mailing list, get in touch with me, and access our full archive. Thank you.